seachtain an Indo-Ascaliger.
Táim I mon iarachtaí a dhéanamh teacht ar a chorp, agus súlagam amach an seo gur féidir é a chur in uaig ceart lena bhaintir féin.
Scíltaí, fios, tuairimí.
Tá sé dochreite nach bhféadfach ara i gcuirna meáin an cheist sin a eicáil.
Bhí an talam a gnám go raibh orthcháir in reachtam. Iadach sé tarann go raibh an orthcháir san i lis dúthail agus go mina fnacht gáir a chlig sár ducha sin éair. Ná ní bhíon ann tar d'oraach sé sin. Vin Marav.
Shachtan. Find us on all the usual podcast platforms.
Remember, you can stay up to date on the latest news with the Irish Independent WhatsApp channel.
Hello and you're welcome to the Big Tech Show with me, Adrian Weckler, the tech editor of the Irish and Sunday Independent. And we're talking about Apple and that seismic ruling from Europe this week. And I'm joined by Brian Keegan, Director of Public Policy in Chartered Accountants Ireland. Brian, you're welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Adrian.
Brian, you were there for some of the hearings. At this point, we know what the ruling was. The Commission took a bit of a walloping, big victory for Ireland and for Apple. But what was the mood like when you were there in the court?
I think the mood was anxious, is the best way to describe it. It's a very, very high-stakes game. It was a very high-stakes game for the Commission for two reasons. First of all, it was really one of their first major forays into using state aid on a tax issue. But secondly, the sheer amount of money involved, you know, had everybody on edge. And even people who got no interest, good, bad, or indifferent, in foreign direct investment or in multinationals or in corporation tax or even in tax generally, you know, say 13 billion, what's going on here? So, yeah, there was an unprecedented level of interest, very tight security around the court building, and a real sense of intensity about what was going on.
Now, I've been writing about this case for years. I've interviewed some of the principals involved, including Margaret Vestager and also Tim Cook of Apple. I, along the way, did get the feeling there was an underlying sense of antagonism and antipathy in Europe that was informing some aspects of this case toward Ireland's low tax policy and big US tech multinationals in general. Did you get a sense of that in the court?
Yeah, it's impossible to see this case just purely in isolation as a case in its own right. You know, there's been a long history of antagonism, if that's the right word to use, with wisdom towards what Ireland does. And it dates right back actually to the creation of the 12.5% rate. We used to have a 40% corporation tax rate and a 10% rate for manufacturing companies. And Europe said, you can't segregate manufacturing companies like that. You have to bring them up so that everybody's on the same rate, expecting we'd land somewhere around 25-30%. It was Rory Quinn at the time settled on 12.5%. And I think that irritated the Europeans big time. That I felt there was a bit of sleight of hand going on there. What they didn't realise was that nobody was actually paying tax at 40%. They were all paying it at 10%. So 12.5% rate was actually an increase for the vast majority of taxpaying companies. You know, we didn't start off well in our corporation tax journey and narrative with the European institutions. And there's always been that, you know, slight sense of intensity. And I would have attended briefings at different times from the European institutions, and particularly in the run-up to this case, and it was quite clear the Europeans were uneasy about the way we were leveraging our corporation tax rate to provide competitive advantage for foreign direct investment. So I don't think you can, you know, draw direct causality between European attempts to harmonize corporation tax approaches and a particular case. But certainly one has informed the other, no question about that.
Yeah, I mean, going on at the same time. I mean, a lot of people would have made, we're slightly off the topic here, but if you look at a country like Germany or France, they have unbelievable infrastructure. They've got access to incredible universities and skills. The argument has often been made about Ireland that, first of all, tax is a sovereign issue within our own competence, not really a federal European competence. And you can be the most pro-European person in the world, but still make the argument that we need something other than our Guinness and our warm welcomes to compete on with some of these larger countries who have all of these unbelievable advantages.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I mean, you know, you cite Germany. Germany is one of the countries in the world that takes the least tax out of its companies.
Sorry, can you just explain that? That sounds completely counterintuitive.
It is completely counterintuitive. But if you look at the charts of, you know, the relative corporation tax takes in the big countries relative to the small countries, it's the small countries that take the most out, quite bizarrely.
How does...
Because that happens because we have a 12.5% rate and we've got research and development reliefs for companies who are, you know, doing the high tech stuff, and we've got a special relief as well if it's intellectual property located in this country, and that is it, and there's nothing else. But if you look at the other jurisdictions which have much higher nominal rates, you know, the German rate famously is over 30%. There are so many reliefs and allowances to reduce down the actual effective rate that those companies are paying, that their take relative to ours is quite small. We're also, Adrian, I mean, when we're coming to corporation tax system, those developed at the back end of the 19th century, when companies made money digging stuff out of the ground and making stuff with it, right? And it doesn't suit the current type of economic activity we have, particularly in the multinational sector where stuff has been traded across borders. So there's always going to be that kind of tension. But your original point, I mean, you know, Spain has a wonderful tourism sector because it's got wonderful weather and wonderful beaches. The Germans, the British, the French, they've got enormous natural resources. What have we got? We've got native cunning and a low tax rate. And one of the points that's frequently missed by analysts, I think, when, you know, looking at what companies do, companies don't really have a great sense of corporate social responsibility when it comes to tax payments. They see corporation tax particularly as a cost to be managed in the same way as they manage payroll, they manage logistics, they manage cost of consumables, they manage energy costs. And they legitimately look for ways to do that through that management. It's not that they've got any sort of particular animus against a particular country or anything like that at all. It's just, how do we maximize the return to our shareholders by managing our costs? One of those key costs is corporation tax, and that's one of the reasons why they come here.
What of this one of the things that came out in this case, and Vesteyer made the point quite a few times to me and to everybody else who would listen, that at one point Apple was had an effective tax rate in Ireland of 0.005%. Now, Apple has contested that and said that was taken out of context, and that's not the whole picture. The actual ruling itself didn't really take issue with that figure. And there's when we're talking about this in a mainstream context, it's figures like that really do have that pack quite a punch. Was that ever an accurate figure to throw out? I mean, and I want to be completely fair to Margaret Vesteyer here as well. Was that reflective of what Apple was paying? I mean, was she right to highlight that?
Well, it depends on how you want to read the figures. I mean, by way of example, let's say I'm an Irish person living in Ireland. I'm an Irish taxpayer, and I do small pieces of work in the UK that falls into the charge of the UK tax, right? And I pay, you know, a few hundred pounds sterling on that small piece of work. Now, is it correct to say that my rate of tax in the UK is 1%? Because I've just got a tiny proportion of my income actually taxed under the UK rules. So those kind of analogies were an actual fact being made. That's the first point. The second point is this. We think of tax incentives as all about getting investment into the country. The American approach to tax incentives for its corporates was actually quite different. It was all about getting US multinationals to expand out into Europe, into the Middle East, into Asia. This goes right back to the Kennedy era. So they devised a system whereby US multinationals could, in actual fact, not pay any US tax until the money they made abroad was repatriated back into the States. And all of the stuff that people have been giving out about, and you know, with some justification over the years, the Apple case, the double Irish, all these structures were actually about US multinationals deferring their tax bill until such time as the money was repatriated back into the States. So it was never fair to say that the effective rate of tax by a US multinational in any European location was X.001%. It was that until the money got back into the States. Now, Indefinite deferral is effectively not paying it at all. And who's fixed it? Well, President Donald Trump fixed it, because he came along at the end of 2017 and he created the U.S. Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And he brought the U.S. Corporation Tax headline rate down from 35 to 21%. But the other thing he did, which never hits the commentary, was he deemed that all of the monies which were untaxed in Europe and in the Middle East and Asia and everywhere else outside of America by U.S. multinationals were deemed to have been paid back into the U.S. Okay? So all that deferred money is now in the process of being collected in the U.S. And it was one of the points that the counsel for Apple made in the case. And it wasn't explicitly referred to in the judgment, but I'm sure it had a bearing on the judge's thinking. He was making the point, look, we're talking about tax here that's actually now been paid in the U.S. Talking about some magic number that's never going to get paid anywhere. It's actually currently being paid, not because of a change in European rules, not because of this tax case, but because the U.S. changed their own tax rules.
Which is a point that Apple makes, and that they say that their effective rate is 26% over there. But I suppose, to be fair to the European Commission, perhaps they were in a position where they felt that Europe is a sovereign entity in its own right, and we can't wait to see whether or if American authorities will at some point insist that their corporations repatriate their profits. And this, you know, while they're considering this, these massive companies are making tens and hundreds of billions of dollars from our sales, and effectively, it seems, not paying any tax anywhere on it.
Yeah, and you're right about that, Adrian, because let's remember, I mean, the genesis of this case is the early 1990s. And the actions that the commission took date back to 2016. So an awful lot has actually happened in the last 4 years. I don't want to suggest for a moment that the commission didn't have a legitimate concern and didn't have grounds. And I think that was even acknowledged in the judgment as well. I think that's right. But I'm just saying that the world has moved on. And you know, future stories might look back on this and say, I can't imagine anything incidentally more boring than a history book on tax. But just in case in a few years' time somebody writes one, they'll probably point to this case and say, well, actually, this was part of the drift that sorted out once and for all.
I don't think this was a boring case, because I think this caught the public imagination for a number of reasons. You had big macroeconomic and political issues. You had issues like tax justice. You had issues like the divide between rich and poor. You had also, on a kind of an entertaining level, in one respect, you had all the speculation about what we could do with 13 billion euro, although it was never clear that even if we lost the case and got that 13 or 14 billion euro in back taxes, that we would be entitled to keep all of it anyway, right?
That's exactly right. And I think that argument, it was a disappointing one to hear rehashed as recently as yesterday, you know, in some of the political commentary. That 13 billion was never really ours. That 13 billion belonged to Uncle Sam. And that's where it's going. And it's currently being paid over. So, you know,
just on that point,
we missed out in some way. They're not right.
Yeah. Just on that point, had we lost the case, Ireland and Apple lost the case, and that order for back taxes for that 13 billion was made, and we took possession of that, or we and other European countries took possession of that, would Apple have been in a position where they still would have paid what they say they're paying anyway to the American exchequer, as well as the 13 billion? Or would they have found a way to say, no, well, we were taxed for that in Europe, so therefore we're not going to be taxed in the US?
Yeah. You're asking me a question there that the answer to which lies on the relationship which Apple, the company, has with the IRS. And I don't know is the straight answer. What I can tell you is that under normal circumstances, and this is not a comment about Apple, but just under normal circumstances, where tax is paid in one jurisdiction which the US recognizes, they generally give a credit for that tax against the US tax bill as if the tax had been paid in the US. So that's to avoid double taxation, paying money twice on the same profits. Whether that applies in this case, I simply don't know, but that would be the general rule.
Yeah. I know Margaret Vestager's statement this week on this issue, and she appears to be she's bowing out, fighting in this. It's not clear whether she'll appeal or not. She says, we'll carefully study the judgment. She says, that the Commission stands fully behind the objective that all companies should pay their fair share of tax. If member states give certain multinational companies tax advantages not available to their rivals, this harms fair competition in the EU. It also deprives public purse and citizens of funds for much needed investments. And she says that the Commission will continue to look at aggressive tax planning measures under EU state aid rules to assess whether they result in illegal state aid. At the same time, state aid enforcement needs to go hand in hand with a change in corporate philosophies and the right legislation to address loopholes. It's difficult to read from that whether that is the opening salvo in an appeal, a final appeal to the European Court of Justice, or whether that is Margaret Steyer saying, no, this is why we took this case. Maybe we won't appeal, but I want to reaffirm these are the principles behind why we took the case, and there you go, and good luck to you all. I mean, it's hard to know, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's as you rightly point out, it's a brilliant statement because you could read almost anything into it. Ultimately, the decision about whether a case is taken to appeal largely rests with the lawyers.
Yeah,
I'm not a European lawyer by any manner of means, but it is
no, neither am I. Thank God.
But to appeal a case further up the line, it can only go on a point of law. And a lot of the ruling in the general court delivered yesterday was actually all about the facts of the case. How did Irish tax rules operate? How did the revenue commissioners actually operate those rules? So a lot of the decision actually seemed to me to turn on their discovery of what the facts were.
Yeah. I was going to say, I remember interviewing Tim Cook in 2016, just after this ruling had been made. And I was in Germany at the time, and it had just come out. So I talked to him over the phone, and he told me at the time in a kind of a bit of an outburst that went around the world. He said he thought that this was political crap. That was the phrase he used. It was political crap. This was a politicization of the tax code, that basically there was an underlying agenda in Europe and in the European Commission to try and harmonize taxes. Sorry, he didn't say these specific words, but this is what he's referring to, because this is what the commentary was at the time. And to be fair, with the judgment yesterday and the fact that the Commission were so roundly rejected by the court, I mean, they knocked down almost every argument. They essentially said that the Commission was overreaching and trying to construct things. Cook is entitled to feel vindicated by his initial reaction somewhat. I mean, he was an outburst, but he's entitled to feel vindicated.
Yeah, I mean, arguably, this case wouldn't have happened were it not for a similar choice of words by Mr. Cook in front of a US Senate committee back in 2012-2013, where the US were looking at the Apple tax bill, and you know, there was a reference made there. There was a kind of a careless language, perhaps, which seemed to infer that there was some kind of deal or some kind of, you know, sweetheart arrangement going on. And that in itself set off a sort of political momentum. So I think the lesson for anybody commenting on, you know, on the tax affairs of their own businesses, just be very, very careful what you say, because stuff does get picked up on, and certainly the European Commission does read the newspapers, and they don't confine themselves to the European newspapers either. You know, this stuff does actually have momentum. In terms of politics, there's nothing more political than tax. You know, even in a failed state, the last institution of state to crumble is the tax system. You know, it's always political. It's always about, as one finance minister put it at one stage, you know, no treasury minister can ever accept the loss of tax revenue to another country. It's always a problem for them. It's always going to be political. The multinationals, by definition, are going to be caught in the eye of any storm that's going on, because they are multinational across borders.
Yeah, I mean, Margrethe Vestager, I've met her a couple of times. She is a star in the European Commission. Very capable. She's very impressive, by the way. She hasn't really put a foot wrong. And even now, you might say that this is just a case that has been decided. Many will still applaud her for having taken the case. Neither you or I are politicians. But I am wondering whether to continue this appeal to the European Court of Justice might be a step too far, even with a political radar on, because it was so roundly rejected by the General Court. If it's appealed and it's dismissed, that then goes to an issue of judgment as to why it was appealed the last time, I would have thought. Again, this is a complete amateur error, off the top of my head, speculation.
It's not amateur error at all. I mean, both of us have been following this stuff, you know, intensively over the last decade. I think you're right. I think there's a little bit of, you know, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me going on there. You're right about how conclusive the judgment was, and nobody wants to compound the error.
Yeah.
And the other thing too is the commission should have bigger fish to fry. I was very taken by a comment by Michel Barnier in, of all places, the House of Lords only a few weeks ago, where he was talking about the Brexit negotiations. And he was talking about just how important the single market now is, more so than it ever was, given the turmoil in the international trading arena. And it seems to me that commissioners would be very, very well employed really focusing on the international stuff and not what effectively is an EU domestic matter. Because state aid is important. I mean, Ireland benefits colossally from the EU state aid rules because it means that the likes of the big countries, France and Germany and Italy and Spain, are not competing unfairly with us. So, I mean, you know, we should be fans of the whole state aid arrangements. But there comes a point when the bigger perspective, and undoubtedly the bigger perspective at the moment, is the tensions between the US and China, the US and the EU, you know, what's going on with the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative. And really, this kind of case is a deflection from attention on those kind of issues.
I would agree. Brian, that's all we have time for. We've got to leave it for the moment. But thank you very much, Brian Keegan, Director of Public Policy for Chartered Accountants Ireland. And now on to one of the big topics of this week. They say there's never any news in July, and that has definitely been the case in 2020. Been a very, very slow week this week. So to discuss the non-news story, that is the massive Schrems data judgment in the European Court of Justice, I'm joined by Castlebridge's Catherine O'Keefe. Catherine, you're very welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So it's going to be difficult to be completely conclusive, I think, about some parts of this judgment. There are 60, 70 pages odd. I know that you have been looking through it, but some of the same questions come up as came up with previous versions of this drama. So I'm going to throw a few at you. If it makes sense to, if there is an answer, great. If it needs a little bit more analysis, no problem also. First of all, what's your overall take on the judgment? Do you have one?
My overall take is that I am not surprised that the European Courts of Justice have been completely consistent and that they're going back to being a court of administrative procedure, which is largely what they were set out to do. This is not at all an activist decision. It is clarifying what rules and scope that the data protection authorities, such as Ireland's DPC, have to make the decisions. So when it comes to the result that the DPC was looking for, they got it. This particular referral to the Courts of Justice was asking for clarification, and the Courts of Justice have given that. So it is good.
Okay, well let's look at that aspect of it. As we stand now, what is the obligation of the Irish Data Protection Commissioner with regard to intervening or not intervening with a data flow from Facebook?
So that will depend on which particular mechanism that Facebook has been using to transfer that data. So that's there are two bits of ruling here. There's a ruling on the adequacy of the Commission's Privacy Shield decision. And that the European Courts of Justice struck down, said that the Commission's decision regarding Privacy Shield is invalid. So a lot of the data transfers were going under Privacy Shield. Those must discontinue, and any transfers under Privacy Shield must be suspended.
Do we have any idea, even in the broadest sense, of what kind of data transfers might have relied heavily on Privacy Shield?
A lot. So Privacy Shield was, as my colleague put it the past few years, a chocolate teapot that was very, very quickly put into place to cover what was previously done under what was called the Safe Harbor Agreement. And it was done, so basically a lot of the commercial transactions under which our data was exported to the US were done under Privacy Shield very, very quickly.
And just to be clear, when we talk about commercial transactions, to the layman, what is a commercial transaction?
So anything that's going to companies such as Facebook that would be done under the rules of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. So we're not necessarily looking at government-to-government transfers there. But anything done under Facebook, all of the nice little companies that we use, such as SurveyMonkey, all the Dropbox, all those things that we use, that Silicon Valley has these nice services that we use, those are generally commercial. They're not not-for-profits, so, they're not governments.
So just again, to be clear, and this is a person on the street who might be asking this question. So SurveyMonkey, Dropbox, Facebook, is this
Gmail?
Yeah. Is this to say that there is now a presumption? Is there any difference in the presumption of whether we can send a Gmail, use SurveyMonkey, use Dropbox right now after today?
Us as data subjects, we can explicitly consent to having our data transferred to a country that does not have adequate protections. So we can decide that we're okay with our data being used by the CIA, so on and so forth.
Which it probably will be, yeah.
Yeah. We still have the ability to, on explicit consent, say, okay, we don't care about our protections. But companies deciding to transfer our data to the U.S., European companies, controllers or processors of data, cannot assume that we're okay with that. They can't say, okay, we're going to guarantee that under GDPR we have protections. So, but we want to use these sub-processors or other services. So again, if the Irish Independent wanted to put out a survey, they could not use SurveyMonkey and say, well, we assume that people are okay with that.
So there would have to be something approximating to much more specific consent from the people likely to be taking part in that their data might be used by a partially US-based service, which may have weaker protections. But the idiot's question is, does that mean that SurveyMonkey or the Irish Independent can take a shortcut through all this by simply requiring that explicit consent at an early stage, a pop-up that says, by doing this, you are consenting to this data being sent to the US, which has a different level of privacy protection to the EU?
The answer to that is no, because by doing that, you are not actually getting valid consent. It's consent contingent on something. So in order for consent to be valid, it has to be fully informed, freely given, revocable at any time. So if you're saying that in order to take the survey, you must consent to our data, your data being given less protection because we're going to send it to a place that we know the government there is hoovering it up and using it for things that we don't know. That's not exactly freely given consent.
Well, then how is it possible?
Same with cookies.
How is it possible to give freely given explicit consent then?
For something like this, you can't really have freely given consent, because it'll mess up your survey if you're using SurveyMonkey.
Yeah. So again, I'm just trying to get a wide view here of the type of services that may be curtailed as a result of today's European court judgment, and that sounds like services like, we've talked about SurveyMonkey, but Dropbox, other services like that. That sounds like there's a question mark now over whether I now today can use my Dropbox, whether Dropbox can continue serving me as a customer here in Ireland.
Yeah, so what a company like Dropbox would be doing would be looking at making sure that they have the ability to keep data within the European Economic Area instead of sending it across the Atlantic. Because what this judgment today did was it looked at two different mechanisms by which they would be allowed to send it to the US. One was the Privacy Shield decision. The other was what was called standard contractual clauses. With those, both of those mechanisms are slightly different decisions, but the underlying question is whether or not there is adequate protections, which would be essentially equivalent to what we'd have in the European Union. Mm. The answer for both of those was no. When it comes to the contractual clauses, what the courts were ruling on was whether or not those contracts are valid. And the contracts are still valid, but if you have a situation where you're, for instance, Dropbox as a company was guaranteeing that they would ensure there's adequate protections, but they have no control over what the government does, that's not a reasonable contract, so you can't actually rely on those contracts.
So I mean, isn't the obvious question there, doesn't that kind of undermine the notion that standard contractual clauses can be relied on? I mean, it's all very well to say that they're still legal instruments.
Yeah.
But if the territory, because, and I know we're confining this conversation largely to the US for the purposes of this discussion, I know the European Court of Justice has to take into account other territories, and we haven't even talked about places like China, for example. But with the US, if the climate in the US is such that the ECJ is, and many Europeans are saying, you do not respect our privacy the way that we have it here, then what's the point in saying that a standard contractual clause is still a valid legal instrument if it can't be used?
Yeah, that's actually the big question. So while this ruling said the contracts are okay, the ruling also said that you can't rely completely on the contract. You have to, as a company in the EU, if you want to transfer data to the US or to another country that is a third country outside of the European Economic Area, you have to do your due diligence and you have to say, okay, I want to rely on these contracts, these stranded contractual clauses. What are the local laws and practices of that country that I want to send data to? If those local laws practices don't give what we would consider to be reasonable, adequate protection, equivalent protection, then we can't rely on those contracts. So basically what this does is it says the contracts are valid as contracts, but if you can't say that, if the government of that country doesn't allow for a company in that country to guarantee adequate protections, then you shouldn't be using the contract. You shouldn't be sending data to that country.
So what we're kind of saying is that SCCs to the US, that way of transferring data to the US,
they're no good.
They're no good. Now, in that scenario, what is it that the Data Protection Commissioner here now has to do?
Yeah, so in the context of standard contract clauses, the Data Protection Commissioner now has to make a decision regarding whether or not all transfers using standard contractual clauses to the US should be suspended. The ruling still leaves the possibility that other countries that have different laws and practices may still be able to use standard contractual clauses. But in that case, if somebody makes complaint about that country, that decision may have to be made there too. The DPC has to investigate.
How can the Irish DPC rule in any way other than to suspend standard contractual clauses with data going to the US?
I would say there probably isn't a way that they can. And that's probably one of the reasons strategically that the DPC decided to refer this to the European Courts of Justice, because what Max Schrems appears to have wanted was for the DPC to make this ruling a couple years ago and suspend all transfers to the US. But there would have been very, very difficult questions regarding the scope of the power that the DPC had to do that, regarding what the actual procedural rules are for doing that. So if the DPC had made that decision, instead of referring it to the European Courts of Justice, there would have been immediately appeals. You know, Facebook would have done a judicial review, and it would have gotten really, really, really messy and probably more expensive legally than what we have now with the referring to the European Courts of Justice. Mm. So instead of doing what the ICO has done, for instance, in the UK, which was make a big noise about we're doing this enforcement action and then having it fall apart at the back end and not actually having effective enforcement, the DPC has made sure that there are very, very clear rules, and now it's very clear that they must act.
And if they do act, and if they pursue the line of thinking that you and I are talking about at the moment, which apparently is what the European Court of Justice has decided today, that would, to a very large extent, vindicate what Max Schrems has been trying to do in this case. But it surely would also mean that the DPC would have to tell Facebook what? That Irish Facebook users are now no longer able to use the service if any of that data goes to any US servers?
So what the DPC will be telling Facebook is you cannot send that data to the US. So
okay.
That's then on Facebook to figure out how they function
function.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been out to Facebook's headquarters in California, that kind of is the brains of the operation. I know we have a big operation here, but the brains is really out there. It's very hard to see how they would facilitate that. But I mean, already we had Microsoft's data privacy chief, Julie Brill, come out today. She tweeted very soon after the judgment, to be clear, she says, if you are a commercial customer, you can continue to use Microsoft services in compliance with European law. The court's ruling does not change your ability to transfer data today between the EU and US using the Microsoft cloud. Now, is there a nuance there?
Yeah, there is a nuance which regards the other mechanisms by which you can transfer data. And one of them is that it being required to complete a contract. So there are, when you go through the legislation in GDPR, there are various mechanisms. One of the unstructured ones is this completion of a contract that was entered into by the data subject. But again, one of the things that Microsoft has done is it's over the past several years made sure that they have data centers by which you are able to keep your data within the EEA.
Mm. So then it's just a matter of fact or evidence as to where your data actually went within Microsoft. And when I think of Microsoft Cloud, I obviously think of Microsoft Office. Okay, these are commonly tools that a lot of people use. I then start to think things like LinkedIn.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm thinking to myself, hold on a second. There are definitely people in LinkedIn who are based in the States whose profiles I see, who are seeing my profiles. That starts to feel a lot more Facebooky than than some sort of enterprise kind of server thing.
Yeah, and there will be a lot of big questions around that. And again, part of this will be the difference between you as a data subject going, okay, I'm okay to let my data go out there, or
do I give that consent? I mean, how do I make that a reality?
That will have to be part of the sign-up procedure. What are you willing to consent to? And again, for various companies, a lot of that will be questions of transparency and due diligence, making sure that people understand when they're signing up to a US-based company, what are we actually letting ourselves in for? But when it comes to EU-based companies that are required to comply with GDPR, they have to make sure that data is kept to those equivalent protections, that it's not just sent off to the US. So a lot of what's required here is due diligence before you sign up for suppliers, if you're the owner of a company or if you're the one making decisions about where your company's data is going. So HR data, that's going to be a really, really big question for a lot of companies. A lot of companies send data across the Atlantic for the purposes of administering HR. They're going to have to make sure they're doing the due diligence to ensure that there are, you know, if you're using standard contractual clauses for that, adequate levels of protection. So, if you have a question, you have to refer it to the DPC or just don't use it. find a HR company that keeps your data within the EEA.
So what is Helen Dixon, the Data Protection Commissioner, what is her next move now? Is it now incumbent on her to, within the next weeks or months, formally notify Facebook in Ireland that it may no longer run a service transferring its users, its European users' personal data to the US unless that data, unless it finds some other legal way of doing it? What is it that Helen Dixon does now?
Helen Dixon will have to make a clear decision regarding the suspension of data flows to the US.
Even just saying that, I mean, because that can be, one interpretation of that is kind of apocalyptic. I mean, suspend data flows? I mean, what are we, I mean, everything is a data flow, you know?
Yeah.
So how do you suspend? I mean, a data flow is a television signal. A data flow is a phone call. It's a, how do you suspend a data flow to the US?
Yeah, again, this will be something where largely she's talking to data controllers and processors, companies in the EEA, or companies in Ireland in specific.
So, for example, you're initially from California, is that right?
Yeah.
I was actually born in Chicago, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. So I have some family over there. I take it you probably have a lot of family there also. So what is it that you, in a worst-case scenario, wouldn't be able to do in terms of communication with your family and friends in the States?
Absolutely nothing. Again, me personally, I'm not a data controller. I'm not a data processor. I'm part of Castlebridge as a company, but we have been quite careful as to a lot of our service providers that we use. There are a couple areas where our company is exposed. Me personally, calling my family, that's domestic use of data. It doesn't actually fall under GDPR. So what I personally decide to do in calling my family and, you know, using WhatsApp to talk to them, so on and so forth, that's not actually in the scope of data protection law.
But is a direct message, is a messenger message?
Yeah. So the direct message, that again is something I'm doing in a domestic capacity when I'm talking to my family. So that's not, my personal use of data there is not covered under data protection law. Now, if that direct message is done through a company based in Ireland, that company based in Ireland needs to figure out, where they're keeping data and what sort of data flows that they are on the hook for.
But just to be totally clear here, when we talk about a company like Facebook, the vast majority of Facebook's commercial activities involve personal interaction of the type of a direct mail or a messenger message or something, or a like or something like that. It's not actually materially different to calling somebody or sending somebody a text. So I'm like, where is the stop-start point between how somebody like you might be affected in using a service like Facebook? I don't know if you use Facebook. If you did, where is Helen Dixon's stricture on Facebook going to affect you as a user? Because it must at some point. If Facebook cannot provide some services or some data flows, then that means that you and I won't be able to use some of the services, right? No?
So I'm actually going to have to pick apart what you just said because
Please
we
do.
Have a misapprehension that that's actually the bulk of what Facebook does is that communications process. We just psychologically still think of it as like the telephone. But most of the data processing that Facebook does is analytics and advertising based on us and crunching all the data on us, which includes crunching all of the data about our communications. So most of what they're doing is not actually the processing necessary to, you know, poke my, you know, friend in California or to send them a direct message. It's all the stuff that they make money off of. It's the analytics, the monetization, the, you know, slicing all that up into figuring out how to direct advertising to us.
But the bit, bit that we're interested in here is not the advertising stuff. That's kind of derivative of what they're doing with the personal data. What the court and what we're all interested in here is the existence of our personal data on within the US sphere that can be accessed or manipulated or spied on or not given the protections that it would here. So for those purposes, infrastructurally, Facebook is a messaging and a communications company, like the phone company, isn't it?
Again, yes and no, because again, what we care about is, you know, our communications going to our friends or family in the US. But it's predicated on the business model that Facebook has. And the big implications are actually for that business model. So yeah, I mean, we care about.
I'm obsessed as well. But are we just a little bit too obsessed with the advertising? But I mean, as a kind of, this is a way to, you know, to put manners on Facebook from the ad point of view. There's the root of this questioning is the person who is asking the question of how does any of this affect me. You know, how does any of this ruling, because the range of potential outcomes that you see or hear or read are vast. I mean, they range from Julie Brill's interpretation, which is almost nothing's going to change. You don't need to worry about anything. Two, I can't remember who I saw tweeting this earlier on, but basically suggesting that and in fact, Max Schrems kind of saying this could shut Facebook's service down in Ireland if you have any US friends.
Yeah, and they're both correct. Is the thing. Okay. So, you know, the Schrems's case, you know, is kind of looking at where I'm going with the business model question, because yes, what we personally care about is, can I, you know, send messages to my friends? But Facebook as a company does not, you know, is not going to be supporting sending those messages if they can't do all the stuff that makes them money. And it's that all that stuff that makes them money that is going to have issues. When it comes to Microsoft, I would suspect, considering the way they've been doing things, that they have prepared pretty well for this type of a ruling, because it's not at all inconsistent with previous European Courts of Justice rulings. They had the ability to prepare. They've put a lot of structures in place already to allow for the bits that they have to be concerned with to remain within the EEA.
I'll just go for one final bite of this. Regardless of the company's or the organization's business model, this ruling surely applies equally to an entity that makes no money whatsoever, that has no business model, but that transfers data to the US, personal data to the US, as it does to a company like Facebook, which has this giant advertising data crunching model. This is about the protection of your data and my data when it enters the US sphere, regardless of who it is that's sending it or how it's dealt with there. So there is still this outstanding question. I haven't yet seen a really clear answer, maybe because there isn't one yet, and maybe because it will take guidance from DPC and others, as to what it could mean for some of these larger companies that we use every day and the services, and whether or not any of them will actually be curtailed. Like next month, we'll get a notice saying, you know, like the LA Times have been doing for the last 2 years, I'm sorry, but because you live in this area, you can't use our service.
Yeah. I won't really expect us to see everything get shut off. What I will expect us to see is a serious onus on small companies as well as big companies to have a look and do due diligence as to where the data that they're sending to suppliers is going. So the big question is actually, do you understand where the data that your company is processing is going? Do you understand, again, when it comes to personal domestic use of data, it's not me as a family member that what I decide to do in communicating with my family or friends in the States, that's not something that I'm going to be regulated on. But you will if the service
doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, but so what we're looking at is those companies figuring out what is reasonable, what is proportionate when it comes to sending communications back and forth across the Atlantic. That's going to be one of those necessary means of sending data that isn't going to be changed.
But does that mean that the European Court is essentially accepting that messaging that we send across to the States, so that's fair game for the US to spy on?
It's understanding that we don't really have controls over, if I'm going to pick up the phone and there is a tap on that phone, I'm calling the U.S., then the U.S. may do whatever it's going to do with data that's in the U.S., but I've made a decision to call with someone in the U.S., so there's only so much that the European government can do about that.
I suppose the court, there could be an assumption, well, I don't know if I'm using Vodafone, which then... contacts AT&T, neither of those companies have told me that there's a likelihood that the US is going to be spying on my phone call or on my text message. So why should I assume that there is? So I'm not giving consent to being spied on. So why should Vodafone and AT&T be allowed to process that text or that call?
That's, again, that's necessary to complete a contract. That's one of those standard contractual clauses. What we're looking at here is, for instance, say I wanted to send an email from myself to someone in France. Is it okay for my email service provider to send that to the US for analytics and for it to be analyzed by the various CIA or other national intelligence programs there? As part of a bulk interception of all communications.
So what you're saying is
so much you can do. There's only so much you can do about sending communications directly to the US. But if you use Gmail and or other email providers, is it okay for the CIA to be intercepting every single email that is sent through that, even if it's not even entering the US?
Only some of them. I mean, the funny thing about all this is, you and I, and probably most other people, especially after the Snowden stuff, I certainly expect that the US, because it's been absolutely brazen about it, and the Brits have as well, and other French and Israelis and anybody else, and the Russians, they apologize for it. I just assume that they're all having a route when and where they want. That's not to okay it. I think the European Court just is absolutely spot on. It's really good that they're standing up in this way, but it's a little naive maybe to think, and maybe that's not the ECJ's problem, but maybe for the rest of us, for the policymakers here, it's naive to assume that we can actually put up a wall, an effective wall, against the US infiltrating our personal data, because they're going to do it.
There is, that is an issue. Again, what the European Courts of Justice can rule on is not really that. What they're doing is they're clarifying the scope of what they can rule on, and they're clarifying the scope of what regulators can rule on. And one of the things that they're looking at there is a question of effective judicial remedy. So, absolutely, France, Germany, various EU countries have pretty invasive surveillance regimes going on as well. if we as citizens of EU member state countries wanted to complain about that, we have a recourse, A, to the Data Protection Commissioner or whatever supervisory authority of that country does. And that can go up all the way through the European Courts of Justice, and eventually the country can be told, no, you have to reform that. The issue with the US is that when it came to our data being sent to the US and processed by a very invasive surveillance regime, we had no effective judicial remedy for that. We had no one to complain to. And that was one of the big reasons that the European Courts of Justice said, no, it's not an equivalent protection. Hmm. So, and that's, again, where one of the places where as soon as Brexit is completed, there will be serious issues for adequacy when it comes to the UK, because they absolutely have a very invasive surveillance regime there, and their UK Data Protection Act, which they are saying is they're going to be their GDPR once they leave, has some massive carve-outs when it comes to our rights and protections, or the rights and protections of people in the UK when it comes to immigration and asylum seeking in particular. So basically, there are no longer going to be adequate protections in comparison to EU protections, and the effectiveness of the regulator is also going to be a massive question there. Again, the Privacy Shield agreement, one of the things that was meant to put in place was having a ombudsperson that Europeans could complain to if they felt that their rights were being violated. And for most of the 4 years that that agreement was in place, there was a big help wanted sign on the roll of the ombudsperson. And when it was in place, it wasn't actually effectively an effective role, or B, independent. And having an independent regulator is one of the key reasons that it was seen to not actually be adequate protections.
Yeah, I mean, the Americans didn't take it seriously. Yeah. Let's call a spade a spade. Listen, Catherine, thank you very much for explaining it, as usual, in terms that most of us can understand. That's Catherine.
I do my best.
That's Catherine O'Keefe there, Director of Training and Research in Castlebridge. And that's all we have time for this week on The Big Tech Show. Thank you very much again for watching and listening. From me, Adrian Weckler, Tech Editor of the Irish and Sunday Independent. I will see you same time next week. Bye-bye.